I called it from New York to Nepal, because if you remember what happened in Nepal, was hit one of the most devastating earthquakes in history. Israel sent this incredible IDF team, a relief team, to help basically save all the people trapped under the rubble, set up this field hospital for the many wounded. And that's really what I want to talk about. Not that specific event, but what is the Jewish responsibility, or responsibility as far as the Torah is concerned, for Jews to sort of be there and repair the world, fix the world. That 760-bed field Israeli hospital that was based in Nepal's capital that they set up, this is back in 2015, Kathmandu. Over the 10 days of its operation, its 150 medical personnel treated hundreds of earthquake victims, carried out 85 surgeries. They set up a hospital, Israel, with operating rooms, image facilities, advanced labs, intensive care section. It had a synagogue and a kosher kitchen in a completely different country. And no one ever calls Israel and says, hey, can you come help? They just go. They've even gone to countries that, you know, they've had strained relations with, which is pretty amazing. And when the Israeli medical team returned, at the time, Netanyahu was, he always seems to be prime minister, he personally greeted them, and he said the following, and I quote, he said, you helped 1,600 people and brought new life with at least 8 births. You have shown the true face of Israel, a country that values life. And I'm sharing this because it's not an isolated incident. Just to run through them real quickly, Israel's consistently, and I'm questioning, it's not like Israel has based everything on the Torah, but Israel's consistently one of the first countries to respond to disasters. Mexico in 1985, Armenia in 1988, Turkey in 1991, El Salvador, welcome, India, Peru in 2001, Indonesia in 2006, in 1994, during the Rwanda refugee crisis, Israel initiated Operation Interns for Hope. They established a field hospital in Zaire to bring medical aid to refugees. They sent aid supplies to Sri Lanka when they had that devastating flood. This is back in 2003. And they were among the first 3 countries to provide aid to victims of the 2004 tsunami. If you remember, that ravaged parts of Southeast Asia. And I remember 2010 when a 7.0 level earthquake rocked Haiti. And Israel sent 250 doctors, nurses, rescue workers. And there was an article on how the mother of the first Haitian child that the Israeli team delivered named her son Israel because of the incredible care that she was given by the team. By the Israeli team, and Rabbi Levine is the rabbi here of the Jewish Center downstairs, a very good friend of mine. He told me that a religious man from Israel, Meir, comes every year to New York to collect money for some worthy causes in Israel, and he came to see Rabbi Levine to collect some money from here, from Upper West Side Jews, whatever, and he told Rabbi Levine that he had rented a car to get around while he was here. By the way, I don't have COVID, I'm a little under the weather, but I'm not like contagiously anything, so I'm just letting you know because I'm a little whatever. Anyway, he rented a car and he made a mistake. He was driving down some highway in New Jersey. He ran out of gas. So he literally just forgot to fill up the tank and he got stuck and he had to pull off. And he's waiting there on the side. He's calling. He's trying to see what he can do. And he sees his Jeep that drives past him and then stops its car, goes into reverse, pulls over, and this large black man gets out of the Jeep, starts walking towards him. Now, he's a bearded rabbi from Israel with a big black velvet yarmulke, and the black man walks over to him and says, are you Jewish? He's like, yeah, he said, and then he just hugged him. And he's like, oh, you know, there's all this anti-Semitism going around. We're not used to just being hugged because somebody said you were Jewish. He says, like, why are you hugging me? He says, I'm from Haiti. My whole neighborhood was devastated in the earthquake. and a lot of my family was killed. We thought the world was coming to an end. And then Israel came, and they cared. And I've never met anyone since that event from Israel. And I know everyone in Israel is Jewish. So I wanted to thank somebody. So I saw you, I pulled over to hug you. I mean, it's crazy. So my question is Israel doing this because it's just like do-gooders? Is Israel doing this because they believe in, this is like part of the Jewish imperative? And I want to ask another question also. It's not just that we're like, that Israel is always there. For such a tiny country, Israel also goes out of its way to show its incredible know-how with other countries. And the technology that's been developed in Israel, right, the first ingestible video camera, which is so small that it fits inside of a pill and it can view the small intestine from within, which is unbelievable because it literally saves people having surgery, invasive surgery. That came out of Israel. And Israel leads the world in the number of scientists and technicians per capita in the workforce. They developed the cell phone and most of the Windows operating systems. The Pentium MMX chip, which was designed in Israel, is the Pentium microprocessor. It goes on and on and on. If you want to see some really cute videos, by the way, I'm a big Conan O'Brien fan. I don't know why. I love the guy. And he went to Israel. If anybody saw any of those cute films, he shows up at Waze, which is started, of course, by Israelis. You know what I'm talking about? You saw the video? It's really cute. I'm not going to give it away. But he's literally going around, like Tel Aviv, from one place to the next. All these famous things have been developed. And it's no wonder why so many Nobel Peace Prize winners are Jewish. We are less than 1/5 of 1% of the world's population, and Jews have won 20% of the Nobel Prizes in chemistry, 26% in physics, 27% in medicine, 41% of the Nobel Prizes in economics. They say that, it's a little of a joke, but it's that out of the four people who most influenced 20th century thought were Jewish, and the fourth guy was wrong. Albert Einstein, Karl Marx, Freud, and Darwin. So, I mean, it depends. Darwin was right about certain things, but always, whatever. So anyway, and you look around the world, even in here in New York City, I mean, and it touches a little on what Kanye West spoke about, you know, when he does make these comments about Jews being in all over Hollywood, and Jews are being, you know, taken over the, you know, in a statistical sense, and I can say this because I'm a Jew, we are disproportionately represented in almost all of the fields. You go into the best hospitals in the world, you're going to see some Kippot, or if they're not Kippot, the last name is Rabinowitz or Silverstein. And you're going to find that in most law firms also, that way out of proportion to our numbers, we seem to be in a lot of different areas. Professors, physicians, most human rights, civil rights movements have been led by Jews. Particularly the ones that have nothing to do with helping Jews, by the way, which is an interesting thing. And my question to you tonight is this all some kind of coincidence? Does Israel just send teams because they're just do-gooders, they want to get in with the rest of the world? You know, Israel's always being kept out. Maybe if we do some chesed, we help some other people, they'll like us more. Is that why they're doing it? And how is it that they're so, I mean, how is it that they, are we just more of an industrious and ambitious people that we have somehow discovered so many cures for disease and won so many Nobel Prizes? Or is this God's plan? Was this somehow part of the prophetic vision? Because God did say that we're supposed to be a what amongst the nations. That's the title of tonight's class. I thought I'd be able to. We're supposed to be a
leader.
I'll go with leader, but take a look at your sheets. A light amongst the nations. An or lagoyim. All right? And by the way, if that is what we're supposed to be, then are we supposed to sort of quit our jobs and, I don't know, join the Peace Corps? And how do like mitzvot, like keeping kosher or prayer, which don't really seem to fit into helping other people, they're just sort of spiritual things we do to connect ourselves to God, how does that fit into the picture? So it's a lot of good questions. Any comments, questions? If anybody, I'd love to hear what you have to say. I'll just keep rambling on if you don't talk. But seriously, if any comments, questions. All right. Yeah, let me hear. Please. Sean.
I had a professor who wasn't Jewish. He was Nigerian. He actually put in a biochemistry slide, which is typically just medical school material. And he actually had a slide dedicated to the percentage of Nobel Prize winners that were Jews. And he's like, I don't know who in this class is Jewish, but I really do think that you guys are just some kind of Jews. And that's all he said.
Right.
I don't know.
It's interesting. And is it, you know, obviously intelligence would be helpful, but, you know, you're kind of a very, very smart people and not motivated. You know, to win a Nobel Prize, you have to be much more than just smart. You have to be very industrious. You have to have, like, a goal and a vision and a plan. Yeah.
I think it's really, like, above all, long-term decision-making and thinking. I think that, so I'm in the middle of a conversion process.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've observed about Ariel, who I've come to a couple classes
yeah.
with, is that she and her family really prioritize long-term, I guess, well-being for the family's welfare. And it's something that I've noticed in the values that you sort of encourage us
yeah.
to practice every day. So like things like keeping kosher or like even prayer, we were talking about last week, makes you better at
I first of all, you said that beautifully, and I appreciate that because I don't know if the goal was there is something about the Torah and the mitzvot and the plan we're on. We're all on some kind of spiritual path or plan that is supposed to not ensure. There's no such thing as certainty, but that can increase the likelihood of success in the world, especially when you take into account that we're probably one of the most persecuted and oppressed people at the same time. What's the most impressive about the Jew is that we've done all of these things with one hand tied behind our backs. And, I mean, if you, most of the leading scientists in pre-war Germany were Jews. They used to actually call them the Jewish scientists. Albert Einstein was just one of many. I mean, he was the most prominent. But is it just brains? So you're suggesting it's not just brains, it's something about the path that we're on. It's something about the plan that God gives us to follow, down to what we eat and how we pray. That's a great idea. Yeah, please.
Yeah, just
Oh, certain resilience.
Certain resilience and discipline that we've had to, it's all about growing, kind of overcome adversity, which creates a certain discipline, and they've applied that to all aspects of life. I think that was one
sort of survival of the fittest, if you will.
In other words, sense.
Yeah.
Also,
yeah.
You know, practices washing your hands and diseases and viruses, and even though they were blamed for bringing on the Black Plague,
yeah,
kept their numbers.
Yeah, Maimonides, the great Jewish philosopher, wrote along those lines that certain dietary restrictions that we have were put into place. The Torah doesn't say this; it's a theory he has, but he believes that one of the ideas behind the laws of kashrut and was hygiene. And washing hands also, it's funny, when COVID broke out and everybody was washing, I was like, oh, we're used to this. I do this every morning before we eat bread, you know. That's a great point. You had a...
Well, I was going to say, like, when we say the Shema, right, there's a line in there that says that we should keep the laws like toward children,
right,
diligently when we lie down, right, and rise up. So I've always thought about that as like, because of those commandments, we were a very literate nation, right?
Yeah.
And maybe because of the literacy rates among Jews, we, you know, that's how, because it was instilled in people from
yeah.
a very early age, that we've just had that nature over time.
So I think everything you're saying is true. I do think there's some something we can't explain rationally. I had this conversation with Michael Steinhardt many years ago. I don't know if you know him. He started Birthright. He's a big philanthropist. And he's a professed atheist. And we used to have like conversations here. And I would ask him, I was like, how do you explain the continued existence of the Jewish people against all odds? And not just existence, but what we're discussing right now, which is success. So he says education. And education is incredibly important. But it goes beyond that. These numbers seem to, you know, there are other groups that are very well educated too. But we've somehow survived as a minority amongst the majority culture, which is really unheard of historically, because one of two things always happens eventually to a minority living amongst the majority. They're either physically annihilated or they are acculturated, they're assimilated. And we've come incredibly close to both, but neither of us actually happened. And the question is, how is this? And now, so there's no technical mitzvah in the Torah. How many mitzvah are there in the Torah, technically? Anybody know? 613. So is one of them to fix the world? but it's not one of the Ten Commandments. Not even technically listed as one of the 613. But bettering the world is really a religious imperative, which is expressed throughout the written oral tradition. So much so that I would call it a sort of a meta mitzvah, a meta issue in Judaism. Not something that should replace or dwarf other aspects of Judaism, which unfortunately has happened in certain parts of the Jewish community. Fixing the world has become like Judaism, and keeping kosher and keeping Shabbat doesn't seem to fit in there. But you could take a look at your handout that I shared with you. A couple of sources here. These are from the great prophets. Isaiah, I'm the Lord. Anybody want to read that? No. Go for it. Yeah.
I am the Lord, I have called you with righteousness, I will strengthen your hand, I will protect you, and I have formed you, and I made you as a covenant to the people for a light to the nations.
Oh, now what does that mean, light unto the nations? Right? So it's found actually in three separate verses from the book of Isaiah, and a lot of the rabbis talk about, you know, bringing something special and unique to the rest of the world. And you have source number two, and source number three. Take a look. You want to just continue with source number three? It was supposed to be this light amongst the nations. This one is not as well known, but it's an important one. Go for it.
And nations shall go by your light, and kings by the brilliance of your shine.
Oh, I'm sorry. Number four I meant. Kingdom of priests.
And now, if you listen well to me and observe my covenant, you shall be to me the most beloved treasure of all peoples, for mine is the entire world.
Okay, so that is God speaking to the Jewish people when? Right before he gives them the Torah. He says, you're going to be what kind of people? You're going to be a treasured, special people to me. And what does it mean to be like the chosen people exactly? What does it mean to be a kingdom of priests? What is a priest? Like a Jewish priest. What do we call him in Hebrew, a Jewish priest?
Rabbi.
What do we call?
Rabbi.
Not rabbi. That's me. I'm not a priest. Kohen. So what is a Kohen's job? And it's a trick question a little, because a Kohen's job today is very dumbed down than what it used to be when a temple was. What was classically a Kohen's job? So they couldn't own property, and they were completely dedicated to the temple service in the ancient temple in Jerusalem.
So they were like, sort of within the Jewish community, there was this one group of people, they were supposed to be the teachers. That's why they couldn't own property, people were supporting them. They were like the educators for the rest of the Jewish community. So what does it mean when God says, I want you to be a kingdom of priests for the world? That just like within the Jewish community, you have one group of educators that are appointed, if you will, to be the teachers, so too within the family of nations, the world community, they're supposed to be also who? One nation that's supposed to be teaching the rest of the world. Now why are we supposed to be teaching the rest of the world? How to make money? How to cure disease? Maybe how to cure disease. But what? We're supposed to be a light to them. We're supposed to be educating them. What? Take a look on source number 5. This is the son of the Maimonides wrote, the priest of any congregation is its leader, its most honored individual, and the congregation's role model through whom they learn to follow in the right path. Become leaders of the world through keeping my Torah, so that your relationship to humanity becomes that of a priest to his congregation, so that the world follows in your path. We're supposed to somehow model ethical, moral behavior for humanity. Look at number 6. In this fashion, you'll be the treasure of all humanity by becoming a kingdom of priests to teach the entire human race to call on the name of God. We are God's PR firm. The Jewish people are supposed to be Hashem's PR firm. Excuse me. We are supposed to be calling out God, even though God's hidden. His existence is not apparent in the world. If you turn the page. Look at number 7. You want to read, William? You want to read from number 7? It's another great rabbi, the Nitziv.
Being an illumination to the nations to cause them to arrive at knowledge of the Lord of the universe.
Right. So what are we teaching everyone about? What's the subject matter?
God.
How qualified do you feel?
A lot of questions. All yeah. This like, would suggest like, I feel like kind of like a proselytizing.
Yes, it does suggest
that. Judaism universally has, obviously Christianity and Judaism are more associated with that.
Yeah.
Curious with that.
Yeah, that's a great, what's your first name?
Matt.
And when you hear Matt's question, this seems to be giving the role of proselytizer to the Jew. And we've never really taken on that role. Do you see Jews out there doing this, trying to get non-Jews to convert to Judaism? You can convert, right? But do you see people trying to get other people to convert? Not really. This seems to imply we should or not. What are we trying to get people to believe in? Are we trying to get people to become Jewish or to believe in God? Those are two different things. We are supposed to be proselytizing in the sense of trying to call out God's name, propose a moral and ethical standard. We are supposed to try to do that. But there are different ways of doing that. Getting up on a soapbox is not a very effective way of doing it. What's the best way to teach anyone? Any parents in the room will know you can talk till you're blue in the face to your kids. The only thing your kids pay attention to is not what you say, but what you do. Talk is cheap and kids know it, and the rest of the world does too. That's why the Jew is supposed to do what? How are we example?
Be the light.
How? By doing what?
Keeping the commandments of the Torah.
By following the Torah. By living a life of Torah and mitzvot, people are supposed to look at you and go, oh, that's much more effective than getting up on the soapbox and try and preach it. Now, I don't know how many people think this way, because you brought up a very good point, you know, because we don't really look at ourselves as, but are we not supposed to care about other people and about their moral path that other people take in life? You know, we've been so convinced that, you know,
I mean, religion, unfortunately, has such a bad name in certainly urban parts of the United States, you know, big cities like New York. And it's like we're imposing my religious point of view on another person. But the opposite extreme is to say, well, I don't really care, you do whatever you want. And people always like to say that because we live in a free country. But if you really say that I don't really care the way you live, that's not a very nice thing either. Like, we should care about each other's... I can't prove it, and I'm not going to hold you to it because I have no enforceability here, but if I believe in a certain truth, wouldn't I want like my friends to like share that wisdom and share that kind of moral path too? And we're supposed to try to do that. Anybody know how many of the commandments are we supposed to try to do that with? Not 613, but who knows the number? So there are seven laws, seven basic laws of ethics and morality that we believe apply to all people. Anybody know what they are? The Noahide Code, good. Do you know what they are? We'll do a few. Whatever you got. Belief in God. Not to worship foreign gods. Good. Don't murder. Good. Ripping a limb off a living animal, right? You know, humane treatment to animals. What's that? Theft is another. And then there's a prohibition to blaspheme God's name and the mitzvah to set up a court system. Now there's a big debate, you know, am I obligated according to Jewish law to make sure that as many of my non-Jewish friends that I know are following those seven laws? Oh, sexual morality. Not theft. Theft is not one of them. Sexual immorality. So... And each one of those things is a whole night's discussion of each one of those seven areas. But there are seven, I think they said that Ruth, who was a great convert to Judaism, from whom the Messiah descends. So I think her Hebrew name, Resh Vav Tati, Tough. The gematria, the numerical equivalent of the three letters in her Hebrew name, came out to 600 and... what's 613 minus 7? 606, thank you. Resh Vav Tav is 606. You know, every Hebrew letter has a numerical equivalent. Aleph is 1, Bet is 2, Gimel is 3. Kabbalah goes to town on this kind of stuff. So her name equaled 606, because basically she already kept the seven Noahide laws, and she was adding on the rest to get to 613. I don't know, it was a little cute teaching there. So that's what it really means to be a kingdom of priests. Now, have the Jewish people done okay in this? Have we gotten people to believe in God and follow some kind of godly path? What do you think? Yes?
Well, like, if there's no monotheism, or Judaism, now it's obviously dominant. It would be called Christianity.
Christianity and Islam,
yeah,
would not exist if not Judaism. Now, you'll say, what would your response to that be? Well,
why did they leave Judaism?
What's that?
Why did they leave Judaism?
Well, I mean, right, so they have different beliefs. And they believe that, Jesus was the Messiah, and our ancestors did not agree that he was the Mashiach, and then later on his disciples then made him into a god or the son of God, what all that. So we obviously can't follow that, and there are things about Christianity obviously are problematic as far as Judaism is concerned. The same thing with Islam, different problems, but they wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Judaism. And look what the Rambam writes. Take a look at number 9. Matt, you want to read for us, please?
Mm-hmm.
Look at number 9. This is the great Maimonides.
Yeah. And all the matters of Jesus of Nazareth, and of the Israelites who rose after him, only to straighten the way of the King, Messiah, and Christ the entire world, serve God as one, as in his day. But then I will turn to the peoples, to declare speech to all in the name of God and serve him unanimously. How will this come about? The entire world has already become filled with the mention of the Messiah. We'll learn the Torah, the work of his soul, and these matters have spread to the furthermost bounds of many nations and unpredictable parts, and they discuss these matters in the midst of the Torah.
What is he saying here, Maimonides? Maimonides, by the way, he considered Christianity to be a form of idol worship. But what does he say here about Christianity? Positive, negative. Why?
They're talking about themselves. They're talking about the Messiah.
Yeah, we gave him a vocabulary. Yeah. We got him to believe in this one and only God. Okay, so they've changed this and they've changed that, and this is wrong according to our tradition and that. But generally, broad strokes, look at what the Jewish people have initiated, or, you know, Torah has. So, it seems as though we're supposed to be a light amongst the nations, and it seems as though we have done some illumination, have we not? Take a look at the next source now. Armando, would you like to read for us on where it says, fill the world and subdue it?
Number 10?
Yeah, number 10, the English. God blessed.
Yeah, God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. And rule over the fish and the sea.
Okay, now that's taken from the Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. What does it mean to subdue the world? Keep reading Nachmanides there. Great Kabbalist and commentator.
God gave them power and dominion over the earth to do as they wish with the animals, the creeping creatures, and all the creatures that live on the ground, and to build, to uproot that which is planted, and to mine copper from its mountains and the like. This includes what it said above. They shall rule over the fish and all over the earth.
Okay. What is that? What does it mean that God tells Adam to fill the earth and subdue it? What does it mean? To build, uproot that which is planted? What does it mean to mine copper from the mountains? What is God telling Adam to do?
Make use of nature resources.
Make use of the resources, and do what with the resources of the world?
Build it,
man. Make it better. And take a look, great passage from Rabbi Soloveitchik's Lonely Man of Faith, source number 12. You want to continue? Dignity.
Dignity is unobtainable as long as man does not reclaim himself from coexistence with nature and does not resent from a non-reflective, degrading the helpless instinctive life to an intelligent, planned, and majestic one. Dignity of man cannot be realized as long as he has not gained mastery over his environment.
Right. God told Adam, you need to live in a certain kind of way. The only way you can live in a certain kind of way is if you master the world around you, to whatever degree. Keep reading his beautiful line, the next line here. Man of old.
Man of old who could not fight disease and succumb from multitudes to yellow fever or any other plague with degrading helplessness could not lay claim to dignity. Only the man who builds hospitals, discovers their techniques, and saves lives is blessed with dignity. Men of the 17th and 18th centuries who needed several days to travel from Boston to New York was less dignified than modern man who attempts to conquer space, boards a plane at the New York airport at midnight, and takes several hours after a leisurely walk along the streets of London.
So what is he saying? What does that mean? He's using the word dignity a little differently than we normally use the word dignity. Saying dignity, we live like more of a brute's existence when we... I mean, I felt this, unfortunately. You know, we kind of feel that way now relative to the way people lived in the 17th and 18th centuries. But if you remember not too long ago when the pandemic broke out, you know, I think we were all thrust back into that world. Felt pretty vulnerable. Felt very subject to the forces around us, like we had no control. And we were living almost like an animal's life, existence, where we could not, you know, subdue the forces of nature and work, make them work for us as opposed to them conquering us. And that is a Jewish imperative. What's the name of the holiday we celebrate every week where we're supposed to not do that, though? One day of the week we're supposed to do what? Okay. Shabbat, we're supposed to pull back. We're supposed to pull back from conquering the world. Right? All week long we do this. And the Torah says this, Sheshet Yamim Tavod, 6 days you shall work,
Vasita kol melachtecha, do all of your work, and it just doesn't. It doesn't just mean your work to earn a living, meaning like your work in the world, and that's why, even though maybe I don't know what everyone here does professionally, but whatever it is you do professionally, if you can see it as part of the work of the world to make the world a better place, like even if you're just making widgets, but that widget was necessary in order for some business that is employing other people to run. Or certainly if you're a physician or you're in the sort of the healthcare industry, but even if you're going over, you're a lawyer pouring over, you know, doing doc review at some firm, some Wall Street firm, and just like, oh my God, how is this helping anyone? But you're allowing companies to engage in commerce. That's important in order for society to function, in order for the world to be made into a better place. Because it's not like God forgot to perfect the world. He purposely created an imperfect world, and he placed us in it to be his partners in the process of creation. And that was the Jewish task. Now that's what everyone is supposed to do, but the Jew was given this mission and given this purpose. And these are all little recipes, and helps me understand why Jews are always at the forefront of these things, because that's our goal and that's our mission and that's our purpose, and we're obsessed with it. We were created for a reason. I'm going to share something completely different now, and that has to do with the way we started. How did the Jewish people begin? What kind of people were we as a nation when we first started as a nation? We were like up here in society, down here in society. Where were we? As what? Slaves. That's how we started as a people. Take a look at number 3. Torah tells us, you shall not pervert, on page 3, sorry, it's source 14. You shall not pervert the justice due to a stranger or the fatherless, nor take a widow's garment in pawn. Remember that you were slave in Egypt, and God redeemed you, and therefore you have to observe. What commandment you have to observe? You have to do justice to the stranger. Who's the stranger? Someone who converts to Judaism. Who's the fatherless? An orphan. And you're not allowed to take a widow's garment in pawn. What does that mean? You can't take a widow's garment in pawn. Let's say a widow owes you money and you have her collateral. Okay, and her collateral is her garment. You have to give back the garment, even though that's your collateral, until you get your money paid back. Because a widow, orphan, and a stranger are three categories of what kind of people? What's the common denominator of those three types of people? A widow without a husband, an orphan without a father, and a stranger, someone who converts into the Jewish community, doesn't necessarily have the same kind of like support. You can go to all the Jewish schools and the Jewish camps and don't know, my mother knows this person, you know, like that kind of thing. So those people could be more easily manipulated, taken advantage of. And therefore the Torah goes out of its way to protect the widow, stranger, and orphan. And Rabbi Salvechik writes, look at number 15, that whenever the Torah wants to impress upon us the mitzvah of having compassion for the oppressed in society, it reminds us the way we were helpless and oppressed. When? When we were slaves in Egypt. You never forget where you come from. The stranger in particular personifies a helpless one that has no family or friends to intercede on their behalf. And that's why not less than 36 times does the Torah tell us be'ahavta sager, to love the stranger. Actually, this is talking about after somebody converts to Judaism. You're not permitted in any way to treat them in a way that implies that they're any less of a Jew than anyone else. And all of this developed us, Rabbi Salvechik explained. The Egyptian bondage, look at 16, was a great value, for it served to implant within us the qualities of kindness and mercy. The Egyptian experience sharpened the Jew's ethical sensitivity and moral awareness.
Is it any coincidence, as I mentioned earlier tonight, that virtually every human rights and civil rights movement has at their lead Jews? Where does that come from? Where is the bleeding heart Jew? Where did that develop from? So Rabbi Soloveitchik suggested that it's like in our DNA, because that's the way we began as a nation, enslaved. And therefore, you know, it's like someone who's experienced trauma, when they see it in someone else, they have an automatic kind of empathy. Now, it can go the other way too, God forbid. People who are sometimes the victims of abuse become abusers themselves. And obviously the Torah doesn't want that to happen. The Torah wants us to take our difficult and challenging past and use it to feel a sense of empathy for the stranger, for the widow, for the orphan, for any oppressed people. This is why Israel has such a difficult time trying as much as best as she can to behave in a moral and ethical way to its Palestinian neighbors, as it continues to be demonized by some for being the aggressor here, because the world is really not used to a strong Jew. We've been kicked around so much. I actually saw this on Bill Maher. Anybody here watch Bill Maher? I saw Netanyahu years ago interviewed on his show. And it was like after one of these wars when the United Nations was protesting Israel's, basically defending herself, but they didn't use that language, but that's what it was, when they get these rocket attacks and the attacks are coming from mosques and from hospitals and from schoolyards. And Israel has a very, very difficult choice, because if they don't shoot back, they're going to continue to invite this kind of attack. But if they do shoot back, then civilians will die, because these terrorist groups are purposely shooting from populated areas, civilian areas. And I remember Netanyahu said to, I don't remember who interviewed him, oh, it was Bill Maher. And he said, listen, you know, as long as the Jew remains the victim, everybody will be okay with us. The Western world will be okay with us. He says, but Bill, we're not going back to the camps. There's nothing about being Jewish that necessitates us being weak. And thankfully we have strength. And for the first time in a long time, we have our own army and our own government, and we can defend ourselves, and we're going to continue to do that. And we shouldn't be ashamed of that. But it all also just seems to, but at the same time we have a sensitivity for suffering. And by the way, that sensitivity is amazing. I just got an email. One of my students is a very prominent pediatric surgeon in Israel, Mark Arkovitz. He actually dedicated our first Torah scroll. He's an amazing guy. And he saves children's lives all the time. And he sent me a picture of this Palestinian father hugging him after he just operated on his little boy. And he said to me, he goes, I do this stuff all the time. He says, like, where's the press? Now, why would they do that? Why would Israel go into Syria and try to help victims of the Syrian civil war, whatever you want to call it? You know, Assad was just gassing his own people. Because we have a heart. And even if it's our enemy sometimes. And Rabbi Soloveitchik suggests that this is where it's coming from. It's coming from a certain sensitivity. And that's really our job, is to sort of model this kind of behavior. I want to share just a personal story. I actually heard this story for the first time at my oldest son's bar mitzvah from my dad, who should live and be well. So my father tells a story about someone who was very prominent in the Jewish community, was trying to get his grandchildren sworn in as citizens while they were in the United States. My dad is an immigration lawyer. And he wanted to save the whole cost and hassle of bringing them in on another occasion. So he called my dad to see if he could get an appointment at immigration, which is now called Homeland Security. My dad called his colleague in Ohio and said that the mayor, the congressman, the senator, they all tried getting it done. Don't waste your time. It's going to take too long. You'll never get it done by the Jewish holiday. It was Passover. So my father figured he'd try one more thing. He just called the INS, which this is the INS, this is years ago, the Immigration Naturalization Service. And he was put in touch with an Inspector Kowalczyk. And Kowalczyk says, look, it doesn't seem like anything could be done. And by the way, I'm the deportation officer. I don't even handle citizenship. But before my dad hung up the phone, he says, you know, I'm from a small town in Pennsylvania. My dad grew up in this little tiny town in Pennsylvania called Oliphant, Pennsylvania. And I remember there was a Kowalczyk family. Any relation? And Kowalczyk's like, he says, yeah, I'm from Oliphant. My mother still lives there. He says, oh, you know, maybe you can help out a guy from Oliphant. See if you can do a favor to help my client, you know. He goes, all right, I'll see what I can do. He hangs up the phone. A few days later, Kowalczyk calls my dad back. He says, who's Harry Wilds? My father goes like, whoa. So that was my father's father, my grandfather. And Kowalczyk says, I called my mother. She's in her 90s. And I asked her if she ever heard of a guy of Wilds. And right away she said, Harry Wilds, sure, I know him. He's the honest Jew. And then Kowalczyk starts telling my dad the story that he had never heard. And the story was is that he's told my father that his father came as a peddler to his mother's house. My Zadie, my grandfather, used to have a store in Oliphant. And when I was a kid, I used to go and trim the windows for him. And whatever he couldn't sell in the store, he would go on, you know, you peddle it. And your grandfather, excuse me, your father came as a peddler to my mother's house, which was quite a distance from Oliphant, and she bought a house dress from him and gave your father a $20 bill. But the change she got back was though she had given him only $10 and not $20. And it was only when he got home he realized he gave her the wrong change. He didn't give her enough money. So around midnight, he comes back, like hours later, traveled all the way back to her home, knocked at the door, woke her up, and gave her the extra $10. And my mother, he said, never forgot that. And then he said, look, there's not much I can do about this case, but the least I can do is try. And of course, he got it done. And nobody could understand exactly how this appointment was able to, you know, it could take months and months and months. Now, I'm sharing this story because the best way to teach is through action. And when you do something like that to someone else and a person is influenced in some kind of way and they know who you are and that perhaps you're doing this because you're following some sort of spiritual teaching of your tradition, that's what's called in Hebrew Kiddush Hashem. That's the sanctification of God's name. Now, you can do just the opposite. Walk around with a kippah, let everybody know you're Jewish, and you do something unethical. That's just the opposite. Maybe we can do a lot of damage that way, too. I remember when my oldest son was very little, and he was walking with his mother on the street, and he looked up and he said, you know, he was like 6 or 7, maybe, and he was like, it's really hard being Jewish. And then she didn't quite understand what he was referring to because they were walking on the street and he wanted to just like splash into like some puddle and go a little crazy, but he was wearing a kippah. And I guess my wife said something to him like, you know, what's it going to look like, a little boy with a yarmulke acting like a crazy kid, you know. And in a sense, even if we don't wear a kippah, people find out who we are. It doesn't take that much to figure out what our backgrounds are. And I think this is one of the most important ways that we're supposed to fix the world. It's not just curing cancer, and it's not just, you know, winning a Nobel Prize, and it's making an impact on other people and enabling other people to know that you're living that kind of life because of the tradition in which you were raised or the tradition in which you now believe. That's called making a Kiddush Hashem, and that is just as great as filling the world and subduing it and conquering it and making this like huge, huge impact. If you follow along on page 3 on the bottom, there's a beautiful story also. I'm going to read this. It's from a phenomenal book called Civility. Has anybody heard of Stephen Carter? Stephen Carter tells a story how in 1966 his African-American family moved into an all-white neighborhood in Washington, and he was 11 at the time. And he remembers sitting on the porch with his two brothers, two sisters, waiting to see how they'd be greeted. 1966, Washington. And everybody just sort of walked by. They stared a little or ignored them. No one else really said hello until this one white woman, who was their next door neighbor, walked over to the kids, and with a big smile on her face, she said, "Welcome," and she brought them drinks and cream cheese jelly sandwiches. And later, Carter, he wrote a whole book. He said that moment changed his life. He realized at that moment when race relations in this country were really very difficult, he realized that maybe a black family could feel at home in a white neighborhood. He later went on to become a professor of law at Yale. He wrote a book called Civility, and he speaks of that woman who brought over the cream cheese and jelly sandwiches. Her name was Sarah Kestenbaum, and he adds that she was an observant Jew, a religious Jew. And in the Jewish tradition, Carter said, such civility is called chesed, he said. Chesed. Chesed is the Hebrew word for kindness, the doing of acts of kindness, which is in turn derived from the understanding that human beings are created in the image of God. William, you want to continue to read page 3 on the bottom? Nothing. This is from his book, from Civility.
Nothing in contemporary secular conversation calls us to give up anything truly valuable for anybody else. Only religion offers a sacred language of sacrifice and selfishness of all that enables believers to treat their fellow citizens as fellow passengers. But even if religion is the engine of civility, it has too few serious practitioners, which is why those who are truly moved by it to love their fellow human beings are so special. I learned that truth in 1966, and to this day, I can close my eyes and feel on my tongue the smooth, slick sweetness of the cream cheese and jelly sandwiches that I gobbled on that summer afternoon and discovered how a single act of genuine and unassuming civility can change a life forever.
It's beautiful. Really beautiful. And these are they sound very like sweet and, but they, this is what makes impacts. This is what changes and allows us to be a light amongst the nations. Again, we have to be able to know what the Torah is to be able to shine a little of a light. And I often say that, I said this in one of my YouTube videos, that sometimes the part of the Jewish community that's not terribly well educated is the one that wants to be the light. And then the part of the Jewish community that's really educated is a little insular and isn't going out there so much. And what we really need is committed, knowledgeable Jews, not preaching, but practicing a certain lifestyle that other people pick up on and emulate. That's what it means to be an Or LaGoyim, a light amongst the nations. Doesn't mean you get on the soapbox and lecture other people, but it's living a certain kind of life and letting other people see that and influencing, being really an influencer. It's not about power, it's about influence. Very, very important idea. Now take a look at the next page. We're just going to go, because it's getting late. Let's just go through a couple of acts of chesed that, of kindness that we perform in the world. It's actually source number 20. Where it says in the Torah, in Leviticus, you shall not take revenge, not bear a grudge against the members of your people. Famous quote, love your neighbor as yourself. Now, what does it mean to love your neighbor as yourself? Do you read that literally? Because not every verse in the Torah is meant to be read literally. It also says an eye for an eye. We don't read that literally. So what does it mean to love your neighbor as yourself? Does it mean you have to really love? Is it actually possible for a person to actually love another person as much as you love yourself?
Yeah?
Yeah?
I think people do that with the family.
Family, maybe. That's interesting. But it says in the Torah, it doesn't demand you do this for every human being in the world, but it demands at least for your fellow Jew that you love them. Not just your parents and your siblings, but some Jew you've never met. You have to love them as much as you love yourself. I mean, it's a good point you're making, because, you know, parents will do more for their kids than they'll do for themselves. That's true. But how far out can you broaden that? So most commentaries don't read it literally. And they say it doesn't really mean love your neighbor as yourself. It means that if you were in that situation, what would you want? Like, if God forbid you have a friend who's sick. So how do you fulfill the mitzvah of loving your neighbor as yourself for your friend who is sick? Ask yourself, what would I want if I was ill? And then do that. Oh, I'd want people praying for me. Okay, I'll do that. I'd want people visiting me in the hospital. Okay, I'll do that. It doesn't really mean love your neighbor as yourself. One rabbi, Maimonides, reads it literally. And the best explanation I've ever heard for this is what comes right after the phrase, love your neighbor as yourself. Take a look. I only bolded, you shall love your fellow as yourself, but look what it says afterwards. What does it say? Yeah, what is that? Yeah, very good.
What is the basis for truly loving another person that you don't even know? Like, I get family. But why do we love? Right, so what is it about? What is the commonality that every human being has? The only thing that really can unite us, because what makes us different from each other is our, maybe the way we think, maybe the way we look. You know, each of us is a different fingerprint. But what makes us the same is that we're all created in God's image. It's really God that unites us. So when it says love your neighbor as yourself, first of all, what aspect of yourself should you love? The Torah is endorsing a little self-love. Now, a little pop psychology for you, it's very hard to love other people if you don't sufficiently love yourself. It's true. People have serious self-esteem issues, have a very hard time building relationships with other people. So that's an important thing, fine. But what part of ourselves does the Torah want us to love? What we look like? How much money we make? What aspect of ourselves does the Torah want us to love? Love your neighbor as yourself. I am Hashem. I am God. The part of you that's godly. Right? We're created in Hashem's image. If you develop and cultivate a love for that part of you, then you should be able to love other people also created in that same godly image. Can I walk into a room? Let's say there's, I don't know, 10 of us, whatever, here. I also see 10 different people. It's 10 souls. And all of those souls come from a higher place. So if I love my own soul, what's to stop me from loving another soul? What keeps us really from loving each other is all the differences that we see. But if we can kind of hone in on what unites us and what's the same about each of us, then loving our neighbor as ourselves is not such an unrealistic thing. That's what one of my teachers suggested. So how do you fulfill this? There's some specific acts of kindness. I put them on the sheet there. We'll finish up with this. So there's a mitzvah to visit someone who's, God forbid, ill in the hospital. If you know they don't want you to come to the hospital, call them up, text them, see how they're doing. It's a huge mitzvah. By the way, we're going to start doing this again on Shabbat at MGE. Before COVID, we did this for years, where we had a group meeting in 95th and Columbus every Shabbat, and we walked across the park to Mount Sinai Hospital and just visit Jewish patients in the hospital on Shabbat. Just wish them a Shabbat Shalom. And now I'm told that we're allowed to do that again. So we're going to actually start that up on Shabbos afternoons. It's a very, very beautiful mitzvah. What does it mean, be attending to the dead?
Or what's the difference between comforting the mourner or attending to the dead? What's attending to the dead? The funeral, the cemetery. By the way, that's considered the highest form of chesed. Why? Of kindness? Because they can't pay you back. Right. Now that's different than comforting the mourner. Right. Now the first part, after the person passes away, the focus is really on the deceased, on making sure they have a dignified burial, a proper funeral. And doing anything involved in that is considered very meritorious. I remember as a kid, this is going to sound a little weird, but when I was in high school, I used to get a call once in a while. They needed the Chevra Kedisha, which is the burial society, needed somebody to stay with the body for some period of time. You're not supposed to leave the body from the time the person dies until the time the person's buried. And so there were people that would come, they would have shifts. You wouldn't sit in the same room, just outside of the room, say some prayers just to be there, and then comforting the mourner, which is a very, very important thing, going to pay what's called a shiva call, or whatever is necessary that helps the person deal with this difficult challenge in their life. On a happier note, how do you fulfill the mitzvah of bringing joy to the bride and groom? Just went to a wedding Saturday night. How do you do that?
Write a big check.
Write a big check to the bride and groom. What about just showing up at the wedding? Good enough? Not good enough. You got to come with a check. What's that?
It's good enough.
Well, they have to see you. And you're supposed to get...
It's good enough to show up.
Yeah, it is good enough to show up. What is your role at a wedding?
Check.
Drink as much free booze... And what's your role at a wedding?
Celebrate your friends.
Yeah. To celebrate your friends. You're actually there, and anyone who's been through this will know that what makes a simcha, a joyous occasion, is celebrating it with the people you love. You could have the fanciest wedding in the world. If you don't have the people you want there, it doesn't mean anything. So the idea is that you're coming to the wedding with a mission. That's why, by the way, how do Jews dance? Some people think because we're just not good dancers, that's why we just do sort of laps. What's the idea of dancing in the circle? What's that?
Circle of life?
Yeah, you don't have to get that deep. But when you dance in a circle, who's in the middle? You put the bride and the groom in the middle. The whole idea is that you're making them the center of your attention. Also, buying a nice gift could, you know, fulfill that too. Hospitality to guests, by the way, not to, you know, burst any bubbles, but like just inviting friends over because you like hanging out with your buddies is not really technically considered fulfilling the mitzvah of achnasat orchim, hospitality to guests. Hospitality to guests is someone who really needs a place to stay, or someone... Why are you laughing?
Because I stayed at your house on Shabbat.
Right, oh, that's right. It was a pleasure. Yeah. Someone needs a place to stay, or... You know, it doesn't have to mean that they're poor. It can mean that they have a lot of money, but no one else invited them. They need a place. There has to be some sort of need you're fulfilling. It can't just be like, I like hanging out with them, easy mitzvah. You know? There's no such thing as an easy mitzvah. Now, we talked about kindness to widow orphans and strangers. What about pursuing peace? That's an interesting one. How do you fulfill the mitzvah of pursuing peace?
There's an argument.
How do you do that without like making things worse? Have you ever done that?
It's in the psychiatry for
a year. Oh, there you go.
So who knows? I probably made it worse by trying to calm it down.
Yeah.
Half the time. The other half the time it would calm down on its own. So who knows?
I mean, it's funny. Like, I just got into a little tiff with somebody. And a common friend of ours was like offered to sort of mediate. Now, there's no money. No one's suing anyone else. But just we're just upset with each other. And we can't seem to quite work it out on our own. So it doesn't have to be like an arbiter, you know, arbitration, mediation, arbitration. It doesn't have to be like a, you know, it could just be that like you're the right person because you happen to know these two people and you can make some peace. Who did this in the Bible? Anybody know who's famous for this in the Torah? Aaron, very good. So you know what they said about Aaron. He was a peacemaker because what he would do is
he fudged things a little also to make it happen. He would find two people in the community that were at odds, and he'd walk over to one and say to him, you know, so-and-so, I know you're in a big fight, but he really wants to reconcile. He just doesn't have the guts to... And he'd tell the other guy the same thing and get them together. That's a very, very beautiful trait. And these are all considered classic acts of kindness. Okay, any questions or comments about any of this fun stuff, mending the world? See, you see what I'm trying to, the last 20, 30 minutes I've been trying to bring it down, because like a lot of people think mending the world means you join the Peace Corps, or you're a U.S. Senator, you have to be like a super important person to, no. Mending the world means, and I'm a big Jordan Peterson fan, mending the world means, you know, first of all, starting with your own house, getting your own house in order. And because you can't really be that much good to other people if you don't have your own stuff kind of worked out. Now, none of us has all of our stuff worked out fully. Okay, there's no such thing. But the basics. And we sometimes feel like we've got to, you know, I don't know, save like some massive cause, and like where we've got the situation right before us. We've got 2-3 people very unhappy in our work. We've got some family members very upset with their life situation. And then we have some friends who's out of a job. There's so, unfortunately, so many opportunities to fix and repair the world. It doesn't have to be this grandiose kind of thing. And who's to say what is more important, what's more significant? The person who makes peace between, you know, the Sunni states and Israel? Okay, that's a big deal. Okay, or you make peace between two people in your inner circle who are really at terrible odds and whose lives have been stifled because of this conflict. They're both important, and each of us has to kind of like figure out where we can kind of make that difference. So it's not just sending medical team to Nepal. I mean, that's awesome. That's incredible. It was also during COVID, I remember, how many older people here in New York City were having just a hard time signing up to get their vaccine. Because if you're in your 70s, 80s, or 90s, it's not so simple figuring out how to just sign up for this stuff online. I remember I went to get my, I went with my dad, who's older, to get his vaccine, and it was a crazy line. It was at Mount Sinai Hospital. And most of the people waiting online, because they were only giving shots to people, they were giving shots to healthcare workers, teachers, and then people like 75 and up or something. So everybody online there, almost everyone online was, at least the line I was on with my dad, was like 75 and up. They were waiting for 3-4 hours. Most people in their 80s can't stand for 3-4 hours. So I remember we were scrambling around, and it just... COVID gave a lot of chesed opportunities, even though it shut a lot of us out and away from each other at the same time. It also reminded us of how much we really need each other. There's a lot of other stuff here. I will mention one last thing in closing, and that is to emphasize how important it is to see this mitzvah that we've been talking about, this fixing the world, that it's tied into the overall system of the totality of Judaism. Being a light amongst the nations is part of something bigger. It should never become a religion of its own. If you do chesed, kindness, even if that person doesn't believe in God, the person you're helping, it's still kindness because someone has been helped. But if you're just doing it because, you know, that's what's in vogue today, and we're not doing it because we're part of a nation that has been mandated to do this, because we're supposed to be this kingdom of priests, like we spoke about before, to be the Kohanim of the world, if you remember, right? Then we're supposed to not only help people with their physical needs, but also to carry out their spiritual path in life. That is our mission and purpose in this world too. And the physical and the spiritual, they go together. And there's a prayer that we say, and I'll use that to conclude. We conclude every prayer service.
Aleinu l'shabeach l'adon hakol. And at the end we say, l'taken olam, to fix the world. But it says, l'taken olam b'malchut shakai, to fix the world within God's sovereignty. And when we truncate the physical from the spiritual, we embrace only the chesed, the giving component, but we reject the spiritual component. We fail to not only fulfill our mission to be a light amongst the nation, but if you cut off the root, the flower will eventually wither and die. If you study history, both ancient and modern, all movements that have latched onto one part of the Torah and ignored another never lasted. And also the kind of chesed of kindness that we perform will be unbalanced and distorted. We had a story of it in this last week's Parsha. Lot, Abraham's wayward nephew, is so careful about giving hospitality to strangers. He lives in the terrible city of Sodom. And the Sodomites, you know where that expression comes from, Sodom, this, God forbid, sodomized a person, was like a terribly corrupt place. They were banging on the door, give us those people, who knows what they were going to do with them. Because it was forbidden in Sodom to bring guests into your home, to show hospitality to strangers. And what did Lot do? He offered up his daughters. It was crazy. You read the verse, you can't believe this is in the Torah. He offered up his daughters instead. Just don't touch my guests. And he was willing to sacrifice his daughter's sexual propriety to do chesed, to do kindness for three strangers. And it was fakakt. It was like an unbalanced, like taking it out of context, doing one thing but not doing the next. There's a hierarchy when we do chesed. What's more important? What's less important? How do we go from this? And that demonstrates that when you're doing chesed, you're doing kindness from a higher place. That our ethical conduct is rooted in our Torah. And then ultimately, whoever we're helping begins to view God in a more positive way. And then we're fulfilling our mandate. We're inspiring people not only to perform acts of kindness, but to be connected to the source of all kindness. God, who created us in His image and charged us to elevate the world with the teachings of the Torah. And that's really our privilege. You know, we can say that we're being arrogant because we're calling ourselves the chosen people. But we could also say that it's a privilege to be God's partners in making the world a better place. And it doesn't mean that only Jews can do this, obviously. But we're the ones teaching everyone else how to do it. And I don't think that makes us arrogant. I think that it makes us privileged in a sense. And we can embrace it and obviously go with it. Or just, you know, be apologetic about it and then not really embrace this challenge. It's really a challenge to be an Or LaGoyim, to be a light amongst the nations. Okay, I don't want to keep babbling on. Any other comments or questions about lighting up the world? By the way, there's one last thing I didn't mention, and that there's a Kabbalistic. The word tikkun is actually Kabbalah. If you take a look at the last page, you can just you can see this on your own. I don't want to keep you longer, but there's the Kabbalah speaks about when something goes wrong in your life, and you want to be metaking it. You want to sort of like elevate it and turn it around. Have you ever heard of like the concept that they said that Moses, his soul, was a reincarnated soul of Noah. Noah, who failed to save the world from destruction, was reincarnated spiritually as Moses. The idea that we have a tikkun. So sometimes you might hear that word in Hebrew, tikkun, used very, very differently than the way we used it tonight, but it's the same idea. Tikkun is just to repair, to remedy, to heal. But it's used in a little more of a Kabbalistic sense as well. All right, next week we're going to be hitting another topic, a little more back down to earth, would be about Shabbat.
We'll tape it. You can't
be here. But, and I think that, is that complete our...
Yeah, that completes this.
Segment. And then we have a little break, and then we're starting another one. How are we doing this? We'll let you all know. You're on a need-to-know basis.
And then after that, on December 9th, we're doing our next Shabbat to air. We're doing like a Friendsgiving theme, so that could be cute, bring friend. And then we have our annual Yard Sale lecture in honor of Ruel's mother, where Moshe Weinberger, who's like a world-renowned speaker, rabbi, author, educator, who's going to come, which will be pretty crazy. He's like a huge deal. And then
that's
December 14th
on a Wednesday night. Okay.
And then we have our ski trip February 2nd and 5th. So sign up for that. We'll hopefully be getting back to you soon.
Any skiers in the room? Yeah. Love to have you all. It's a great trip. It's awesome.
Is the dinner on the 14th here?
No, the dinner's on the 9th.
No, the rabbi.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, that's not a dinner. That's just a lecture. He's a very, very special personality. It took us a long time to get him. His name is Rabbi Moshe Weinberger. Really awesome. So, yeah. And anyone interested, also, every Wednesday night we have one-on-one learning. If anybody's interested in getting your own private trainer or anything like that, you can let us know. But stick with us. We're going to continue this Monday nights. And if anybody wants more information about joining this little bar bat mitzvah group, much of that program is fulfilled through this class. So just speak to, talk to Leah about that. And I hope you'll do some illuminating of the world this week. Right? Yeah, my pleasure. Have a great night. And there's some cold pizza, so enjoy it.